Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with just some of the stories that really count. Coming up on our program today, the value-added tax mess. Is it poor fiscal planning or just a U-turn dressed up as flexibility? The growing influence of non-label brands, trade shocks, and the new short-term insurance squeeze, and accountability in public relations, PR reclaiming ownership in a shifting industry. It's Tuesday, the 29th of April. Now, the finance minister's late-night decision a couple of weeks ago to scrap the planned VAT increase just days before it was due to come into effect has raised more questions than answers. So what does this mean, this U-turn mean, for taxpayers, for businesses, and South Africa's already stretched public finances? And I guess what we should also be asking now is what to expect from a tax policy perspective going forward. Joining us to answer those and a couple of other questions is Thomas Laban, who is a master tax practitioner at Latita Africa. So, Thomas, let's start with the reversal, if we can, before we get into the nuts and bolts. Do you think this was simply poor fiscal planning or a political U-turn dressed up as policy flexibility?
Well, good to be here, Jeremy. And to answer the question, it's difficult to say. We try to veer away from the political side of things, but it does seem like this is something that could have been better handled and perhaps with better participation by the parties involved in the GNU. At the end of the day, the reversal is something that will be lauded far and wide, and whether it was clumsily done or correct to do so, that remains to be seen. I suppose the value of the rand is what should tell you the answer to that.
The reality of the situation, of course, is that we now have a 15 up to maybe 20 billion rand hole in the budget. And that is raising questions about where the money comes from, if not value added tax.
Of course, in some estimates, they even go up to 75 billion rand. I think what's lost in all of this is the power of SARS. SARS has been allocated a further budget and has a history, at least in recent years, of pulling rabbits out of its hat and making good on its promises when it's been better resourced. We respect the commissioner and his steer for SARS, and we're hoping that they'll be able to make up the shortfall, whether it comes from VAT or income tax or other areas. It's no secret that South Africa does have a chronic tax compliance problem, and one surmises that when you attack that better, you deal with the further ills that come from shortfalls in revenue.
So that's the wider policy paradigm. Let's pivot now to your area of expertise. And Thomas, from a tax practitioner's perspective, this surely is disruptive now to backtrack on a revenue policy just days before implementation. What practical consequences are you noting?
Well, firstly, there's legislative. We need to remember that this is law that has been passed. So a reversal would require feasibly a full parliamentary process undertaken, which is incredible. I've certainly never seen this done with such a quick turnaround. There is, of course, also the controversial court case that has been found in favor of the applicants that regards Section 7.4 of the VAT Act unlawful. And requiring changes there. And perhaps you could steer me better with the question, Jeremy, to give you a better answer. But practically, from a business perspective, either you'll have businesses not implementing the changes. They'll have to make no changes at all. Or if they have communicated an increase in the VAT rate, they'll be charging further communication to reverse that, which many of us have already seen. However, we do sympathize with those larger businesses that have had to incur further expense and highly urgently to re-update systems that have had to be adjusted for the new VAT rate.
And of course, customers themselves need to be very vigilant about those changes to see whether that reversal is being reflected, surely.
Absolutely. The problem with VAT is that it's not often that you can simply reimburse somebody who has paid too much VAT. If you think about a grocer, how is a grocer supposed to find each of its customers that has paid too much VAT? So ultimately, that responsibility will fall on the consumer.
And in that respect, then, it also sends out a very opaque and difficult message to business owners and, I guess, chief financial officers who are trying to plan around long-term fiscal certainty. Again, this has upended everything, hasn't it?
It's very difficult, and it does not send the strongest signal of stability. But one hopes that this is merely a bump in the road with the smoother ride afterwards, given the lessons learned along the way.
So, Thomas, what advice now are you giving to your clients in terms of preparation going forward? I mean, for instance, has there been chatter around a personal income tax increase, given that we've pivoted away from VAT?
What you'll see there is less likely an increase in personal income tax and more a freeze in the rates as they are, resulting in bracket creep. Remembering that inflation does devalue a currency over time, if you pay the exact same rate of tax in terms of the same brackets this year as opposed to last year, in proportion to your purchasing power, you are paying more tax. But we're highly unlikely, in our view at least, to see further increases in the corporate income tax rate, the personal income tax rate, and any income taxes at all.
But there is an inordinate amount of pressure now on the South African Revenue Service, and maybe starting to quietly tighten the screws elsewhere, maybe through increased audits, maybe tighter enforcement to make up for that shortfall. And as we discussed a little earlier, anywhere in the region of 15 to 75 billion rand.
It is a very difficult balancing act that SARS must now follow through with, because on one hand, it is more critical for SARS to collect, which, as you say, one would expect increases in audits, more robust enforcement in many cases. But at the same time, it's still important for SARS to pay attention to its PR. SARS cannot, must not, should not be seen as the villain, but given stronger investigation and enforcement measures taken, it's difficult for that not to be the case. So we don't envy the commissioner. I'm sure very few do, but we're very hopeful that they will follow through in recouping the shortfall.
Do you think, and this is a final question to you, Thomas, that there is a trust issue now? So we've had this reversal. Could it conceivably undermine trust in the government, in Treasury's ability to stick to a credible rule-based tax policy?
Good question. And we're uncertain. On the one hand, this is something that would inevitably shake investor confidence in the South African fiscus. But on the other hand, pundits have commented that this is a good test of the GNU and something that, as I'd mentioned earlier, possibly shows the lessons that are being learned in real time, so-called teething pains. The view that we cautiously hold is that we will see things run more smoothly in future. But again, this is something that has shaken our climate right now.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Thomas Laban. Thank you indeed, Master Tax Practitioner at Latita Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, private label brands, it seems, are booming in South Africa, with sales now topping 98 billion rand a year and growing faster than many name brands. There's new research from Nielsen IQ that shows more consumers are embracing store brands, and not just for cost, but also for quality and, would you believe, even status. So what is behind the shift and what does it mean for big name FMCG brands? I want to talk to Kelly McGuinness now, Market Insights Lead for Sub-Saharan Africa at NIQ, the global marketing research firm. Kelly, a very warm welcome to you. That number, 98 billion, let's start with that in private label sales. What do you think is driving the surge?
So it's quite complicated in terms of a few things. I think firstly, we look at private label many years ago was seen as an inferior product. And what we're starting to see is that consumers are not seeing it as an inferior product anymore. They're actually seeing that there's two options for private label. Number one, the private label, because the retailers in South Africa have put a lot of investment behind these brands, they are tiered. So there is an option for a cheaper alternative to branded products, but they're also now starting to offer the quality of branded products. So there's twofold drivers for the growth. Number one, consumers looking for a cheaper alternative because of the economic pressure that they're facing. And number two, they believe that the products are very good products and they believe in these products.
It's also interesting that you mentioned that the private labels themselves are now starting to tier and many of them going for the premium market. Why would that be happening, Kelly? And what categories, in your opinion, then are leading that trend?
So it's very dependent on category, like you say. So there are a lot of categories where we see private labels sort of searing ahead. And in most cases, private label are actually growing ahead of the branded products. And there's almost a realm for both to list and list in harmony, where we can see both branded products and private label come together on the shelf and win for the consumer because there's different offerings. And we do see in some categories where the premiumization has actually come through and the consumer is saying that it's actually better than some of the branded products.
It's about trust and brand, I understand that, but also a lot of it surely has to do with price. And we know overnight the movement on pulling back as far as value-added tax is concerned. As a result of that, would there be then a shift back in favor of named brands, all driven by price?
Not necessarily, because even though we have seen a little bit of the relief for consumers in certain spaces last year, so where we did see some relief in terms of the reduction in terms of interest rates, those kind of slight sort of relief for consumers, even though we see that, the private label continues to grow. So it's not always about offering the cheapest alternative. In some cases, private label is actually being the option chosen for, even if it is more premium than the branded products.
And Kelly, to what extent is Gen Z and even millennial behavior influencing this boom in private labels?
So the Gen Z behavior is quite interesting because the younger generations are looking for options to support themselves and not only that, but also treat themselves. So when they're looking for an option to treat themselves, they are looking for a premium option to treat themselves because we're spending so much more time at home because we don't have the money to do a lot of outside activities. So we are spending a lot more time at home. So we want to treat ourselves in home. And that sometimes means buying a brand that they feel that has some status. And I think we're saying that the private labels have gone from not only having a stigma and they're actually moving towards a status brands themselves as well. And with the younger generations looking for a status brand, some of these private labels are giving them that status brand.
So if I'm a brand manager for an established global FMCG brand, the shift surely would be worrying because there's now a greater degree of risk, if I'm hearing your argument.
There is a greater degree of risk for the branded products because these products are now competing sort of on par with some of the branded products. However, I think there is a way for them to be in both. So the retailers can't only list private label because consumers are saying they still want branded products and they still have brands that they are quite loyal to. And they are willing to shift to a different retailer if they don't find the brand that they're looking for. So it's retailers need to be careful and make sure that they are listing both branded products and their private label, so that the consumers find that what they want. And I think manufacturers and retailers need to work together to make sure that they're offering the consumer the entire repertoire of brands that they can choose from.
And how does that look like in practice, that collaboration or cooperation between retailers and manufacturers? Apart from listing, what else should they be doing?
I think it's around working together in terms of ensuring the right shelf space for the different brands, ensuring that they are offering the full range for the consumer so they find on shelf exactly what they're looking for. Not only that, they also need to be mindful of the fact that there are times where a consumer does need a cheaper alternative, and if the cheaper alternative is still going to grow the brand as a whole and offer the consumer an option to not drop the category completely, where we have seen that be the case in some cases, at least the consumer is still staying in that category. And then the retailer wins, and so does the brand. The same token, we also see the branded products, because there's a cheaper alternative in some of the private label categories, they're bringing new consumers into that category because there's an easier starting point. So then they can move up and tier up into the branded products.
And I'm also wondering to what extent loyalty programs, which are fairly ubiquitous right now, are influencing consumer choice between private and named brands.
So loyalty programs, I think we've seen a massive rise in that in the last 2 years in South Africa. And a lot of South Africans saying that they use their loyalty programs and different loyalty programs across different retail segments to save themselves money. So we don't have a lot more money, so we're looking for ways to save money. And as a result, loyalty programs are number one saving strategy of South African consumers. And that comes with any loyalty program that's linked to retailers themselves as well as brand as well. So any loyalty cards or that kind of offering from a brand is also driving a lot of the behavior.
And that is a fascinating look at consumer behavior in 2025. Kelly McGuinness, thank you very much indeed from NIQ, the global marketing research firm. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as South African consumers and businesses brace for a potential VAT hike, not necessarily now, but possibly in the future, but also feel the fallout of rising global trade tensions, one cost is quietly creeping up, and that's higher short-term insurance costs. Higher premiums, thinner coverage, a shrinking economy, and that puts the entire industry under pressure. So joining us to discuss what could be a perfect storm and whether insurers are offering enough value for money in these volatile times is Matthew Ghazani, who's Franchise Development Manager at Consult by Momentum. So Matthew, a very warm welcome, and let's be blunt. Costs go up. We've avoided a VAT increase, but the reality is premiums are rising. But insurers aren't necessarily pocketing the extra money. Why does it feel like policyholders sometimes always end up worse off?
Yeah, so the industry, unfortunately, is, well, fortunately, depending on how you look at it, is a compliant sort of regulated industry by the FSCA as well as the Prudential Authority. And part of that is how we relate with our clients. And a VAT increase or any sort of fiscal changes does not generate additional revenue for the industry. Therefore, these are costs that are passed on to the end users, so being your policyholders. Unfortunately, the industry does quite a lot of calculations in terms of how they determine their pricing methodology. And part of that looks at volatility. They try and do quite a lot of predictive analysis just to understand what might potentially happen. And unfortunately, the more volatile an industry is, the worse off the pricing becomes, because ultimately, insurance companies are businesses, and therefore there's a level of profit that they need to generate in terms of them doing business in a specific industry. So these costs are costs that will always be pushed down to sort of the end user, the clients. And with short-term insurance, the more volatile an industry, the more pricey it becomes. It's just one of those things that, because the policy benefits only come at claim stage, insurers have to make sure that they price themselves accordingly in order to be able to satisfy those claims. So it is a sort of an unfortunate scenario, given that the industry is very susceptible to sort of volatile changes in economic activity.
And in that respect, it all comes down to proper forecast modeling. So we have the US tariffs, for instance, which you know are threatening exports. But are insurers prepared for those knock-on effects, or was the industry simply reacting after the damage has already been done?
So there is a level of preparation that does go in play. So with the tariffs, as we know, a lot of South African businesses would be impacted. And these are businesses that would be doing business in the USA. their products will either become less attractive to the US market because of the price elements. And therefore, these businesses, what they'll have to start considering is how do they create some sort of saving in their value chain? So do they look at cutting sort of production costs? Do they look at cutting costs around ancillary products like insurance? And typically, insurance is one of the items that sits at the forefront of sort of a cost-cutting exercise. And therefore, it's one of the things that we see causes a huge growth decline in the industry because of policies that start lapsing as a result of volatility in the industry. So insurance companies do prepare and factor in those changes. But again, if it is a sort of a huge and blanket volatility event, so if you consider COVID being a very huge and sort of blanket event with the tariffs, that would be a huge sort of blanket event. It becomes quite difficult for them to price themselves accordingly. Typically, conversations do take place with individual clients at a policy level perspective to try and see where cost cutting could take place between an insurer and a client. But as soon as it becomes sort of a blanket, it becomes quite difficult for the insurance industry or any financial product services company to try and navigate around that. And I think, unfortunately, again, like I'd mentioned, the industry is always in the forefront when it comes to cost cutting, because insurance is something that is a grudge purchase. You only really feel the benefit of it at claim stage. So it's not tangible. So therefore, it's easy for business owners and policyholders to simply cut that cost because they don't see the benefit of it immediately.
So if that's the case, that consumers don't see any real benefit or any real value in the product, surely it signals a failure as far as the industry is concerned on how insurance is positioned and delivered.
I would tend to disagree, because I think when you look at sort of the claims payments, there's quite a lot of sort of benefits that the industry has actually added to just the South African economy. I mean, the insurance or the financial services sector is one of the top producing sectors when it comes to GDP contribution. There's quite a lot of individuals that are employed in the industry. And again, because short-term primarily is based on assets, so we insure assets that are physical. And should those assets get damaged in whatever shape or form, we are able to put clients and businesses in the very same positions that they were prior to that incident happening. So we really do quite a lot of resuscitation of events that have taken place. And again, this is only felt at claim stage, which is a promise that gets delivered at a later stage. So I think the conversation then shifts to how well are we communicating that promise of resuscitating businesses to their current states. And again, it speaks to the longevity of financial services, right? So all these businesses are reliant on the ability to sustain themselves long term, and they need that assurance that there is cover that's available that will help them continue operating in those spaces.
But the bigger risk here is that businesses, if faced with a situation that you've just outlined, are simply going to reduce cover or cancel it altogether. That leaves everyone exposed, including the insurance industry.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is a vicious cycle if there is a lack of sort of education or conversation that takes place in the industry. So financial advisory is sort of paramount. It's very, very important for businesses and policyholders to have a conversation around what affordability means to them. Insurance policies are designed in such a way that there are various mechanisms built into a policy that can help reductions of premiums. So again, it speaks to what is important to a business owner, what sort of covers are important and necessary, and what sort of covers are nice to have that perhaps a financial advisor can actually help a client navigate any sort of potential claims. So it's very, very important that, again, education around the industry, advice around the industry continues to increase, because I think that's where we should be able to find a fine balance between what the cost implications are and what type of covers are really necessary for sort of going concerns for businesses and policyholders.
I'm going to leave it there. Matthew Ghazani, thank you very much indeed. Franchise Development Manager at Consult by Momentum.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the public relations industry loves to talk a good game about storytelling, about reputation, about strategy. But behind the press releases and polished pitches, there is a quieter crisis. Who actually takes responsibility when things go wrong? Now, Bradley Howland is the Chief Executive Officer of the Alchemy Collective, and he's calling out what he sees as an accountability vacuum, where often blurred roles or timid leadership and client politics leave both success and failure unclaimed. And he's going to join me now to discuss why PR might be suffering from a credibility problem all of its own. So, Bradley, a very warm welcome to you, and let's cut straight to it if we can. Public relations loves buzzwords like transparency and trust, but isn't the industry itself often built on spinning uncomfortable truths for clients, and therein often is a conundrum?
Absolutely. I think it is something that we've seen playing out on a daily basis, both, I think, inside agencies and with the client relationships. And a large part of it has actually got to do with the ownership and responsibility and accountability side of things. What we're seeing is that we're not pushing back properly, we're not engaging with clients responsibly, and we're also not setting the right parameters for success. So when we look at great stories, often what we're seeing is that we are very quick to say yes to a client's demands, but at the cost of success that is then generally shared between both clients and the agency itself. And so that does become a big issue. And accountability ultimately can either be seen as the biggest part of that. You know, there's lots of economic pressure at the moment, high expectations to do fast turnarounds and get great wins for clients, but at what cost? And I think that's something that we've seen not play out in the way it should in agencies, and also, I guess, with that relationship with the clients as well.
Let's come back to accountability in just a moment, but maybe just widening the lens slightly. I would also suggest to you that it's not just a public relations issue, but it's a supplier relationship with a client. Doesn't matter what industry it is. And the reality for that that skew is that no one wants to lose the business.
So true, right? And it is actually something that a very well-known advertising exec said at an event I was at a couple of years ago, where he made it very clear. He said that we shouldn't see the relationship with clients as a partnership. There's no such thing as partnerships. It's a service provider contract, and we should remember that when doing work. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that. I think, you know, yes, budgets are tight. Everybody's desperate for revenue at this point in time. But at what cost? I think, you know, at the end of the day, it, in my opinion, it really does need to be seen as a partnership where both parties are setting up an environment for success. And if there's not that mutual respect and understanding of a shared goal or vision to create that success, it's going to fail. And people are going to get disappointed. And so this idea of, well, you're just a vendor, you're just a service provider, I must just do whatever I can to make this client happy so that we can keep bringing the money in, often actually costs more than the reward is worth. And I think that's something that, especially within agencies, agency leaders really need to start understanding that more, is that there does need to be that level of respect that comes with honest conversations, and also making sure that the environment is set up in a way where, on client side, there is this understanding that they also have a part to play in creating that success.
But it takes maturity to have an honest conversation, and that would be the cornerstone of the partnership. But often that doesn't exist. That type of behavior is completely absent.
It is. And I guess those who don't have that maturity are often the ones who are going to suffer the most, right? You know, when we talk about this idea of having hard conversations and setting up an environment for success, it means that sometimes it's not about keeping the peace. Often we see that agencies are very quick to keep the peace, over service, over deliver, say yes to everything at their own expense. And that's where the trap starts, right? So it does mean that I think as leaders in business, that maturity also starts with a little bit of bravery to have some tough conversations, to reset that sort of expectation and also that environment where we are trying to avoid the sort of, I guess, culture of passivity where we kind of mistake that as professionalism. Instead, I think we need to draw that line in terms of, well, what are we trying to achieve, and set up, you know, the very clear expectations that in order for things to work, it means that sometimes we're going to have to say no to things in order for the longer term gain.
But you show me an agency that's going to say no. It doesn't exist.
It's starting to, though. And I think that is something that we're starting to see a lot more, is the scope creep, I think, is getting bigger and bigger. And agencies are becoming a lot more strained at the moment. You know, with a lot of the work that I do also on Preza's side, we're seeing this across the board, is that so many agencies are saying yes at the expense of their own business success and sustainability, simply to bring in and keep that revenue and keep clients happy. But it's actually not working. And so there has been this big move to actually start setting up fair parameters. On Preza's side, one of the things that they're busy doing at the moment is developing an accountability charter, which ultimately formalizes defined roles, timelines, expectations, and even consequences in the work, both on the agency side, but then also on the client side, to say, look, if we want excellence, this is how it's going to look, this is how we measure it, and this is how we hold each other accountable to that, so that at the end of the day, we're all working towards something that is going to be successful. It is something that has been done before. I guess it's when we look at the professionalization of the sector, it means that if you look at a relationship that you might have with a doctor or accountant, you wouldn't push those boundaries to the point where you diminish the expertise of the expert in the room. And I don't feel that as communicators, where it's probably needed more now than ever because of misinformation, disinformation, that we should undermine the expertise that we have as a sector. And it means about setting that standard to say, look, we are professionals and we're here to provide that expert counsel. And so it is about setting those right parameters and also setting the boundaries. From my experience, I've often dealt with you know very senior executives and CEOs in business who have dealt with very difficult conversations, and if everybody's saying yes to them, it's often the one thing they don't want to hear because it leads to more of a disaster. You do need that person in the room who is willing to say no. And those, I've seen this with quite a few agencies who are starting to step up and realize that actually say no is probably the most valuable guidance or counsel that you can actually give to a client. And clients do actually respect that. I don't believe that it's a thing of they want you just to simply say yes every single time.
And all of that, of course, is predicated, as you said a little earlier, on having some courage. Bradley Howland, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of the Alchemy Collective. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We are back tomorrow, live at noon, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.